the technical team. Thank you for obliging me and for coming a little bit closer. So we are going to have a chat, really. It's going to be conversational. So I also want to welcome your questions, your engagement. Please feel free to engage with the panel as we carry along. And apologies again for the delay in starting. Okay. So this session is on the dialogue with African biotech leaders. And we are going to be talking about fueling African biotechnology, the industry, and touching on navigating funding and investment. And this was inspired by a survey that we did back in March, earlier this year, with over 37, I think, entrepreneurs from across 6 countries in Africa, a good split between male and female entrepreneurs, over 23 male and I think 14 female entrepreneurs. And they expressed the need for a platform where biotech entrepreneurs on the continent can engage, network, collaborate, and also exchange best practices. So in collaboration with BioAfrica, we decided to have a few pre-convention sessions that happened between the months of June and August, where we engaged with different target audience categories among biotech leaders in Africa. We talked with, in the first webinar where this platform was launched, we spoke with young entrepreneurs. We had one of the winners of the startup stadium back in the African Health ExCon talk to us about his journey. And then in the second session, we engaged with more experienced biotech leaders, as well as biotech leaders from the diaspora. And in the third one, which happened to coincide with Women's Month in South Africa, we had a panel for women leaders in the African biotech industry. So at BioAfrica, we wanted to have an in-person event to officially launch this platform. And over the subsequent months after this convention, we will be keeping you informed of how this platform would evolve, because we really want something that will be ongoing and serve, you know, to respond to the needs that were expressed during the survey. So without much ado, today we will be looking at a topic that is so vital for everything and notwithstanding biotech entrepreneurship, which is funding and how to navigate that challenge as well as its opportunities in our landscape. And I'm joined today by 4 special guests. We have from all the way from Mauritania, Dr. Alama Elmedi. She's a medical doctor by training, but also the CEO of Profamedis International, which offers consultation services in market access, health economics, and more in that line. So thank you, Dr. Alama, for joining us. And just to apologize, Dr. Alama may take leave of us because she also has a flight to catch. But we'll let her express herself and tell us a little bit about what's happening in the funding landscape in West Africa, Francophone Africa, as well as in North Africa. And then also I have Mrs. Kim Hewlett, who is one of the pioneer leaders in biotech in South Africa. She's been in the game for over 18 years. She's a co-founder and CEO of Next Biosciences, which is a biotech company that operates in the space of reproductive health testing, as well as stem cell banking, and also producing biologics out of placenta, and a whole lot of other things, lifestyle testing. And they were very instrumental in South Africa during the COVID pandemic, supporting in COVID testing. So thanks, Kim, for making the time. Next is Marco. Mr. Marco Gianmarco Melfi. He's an investment principal at OneBio. OneBio is one of, if not the only, venture studio in Africa that focuses exclusively on life sciences, converting life sciences into businesses. And they offer investment capital and also know-how in building companies for the future using or based off life sciences. So he's also here to give us the venture capital lens to getting funding for your biotech venture. And last but not least, we have Dr. Wisile Pehane. I hope I said your name correctly. He is an executive for bioeconomy at TIA, Technology Innovation Agency, which is a national public entity, South African public entity, that is aiming to close the gap, the innovation gap between R&D that is done in our public and private institutions and the commercialization of this innovation. So without much ado, I will just proceed to ask Dr. Wisile to come onto the stage and give us a presentation of the funding landscape in the African ecosystem. Thank you.
Thank you, colleagues. The set of slides is really meant to stimulate some discussion within amongst ourselves and yourselves as the panelists and the audience. I'd like to just talk a bit about a few things, one of which is the South African funding landscape. On the left is, in essence, the National System of Innovation Players, which ranges from government funding, the producers of the intellectual property, and various other partners within, let's call it, the value chain of technology development and commercialization. On the bottom, from left to right, is in essence the various stages of technology development, whether it is ideation, early stage technology development, right through to commercialization and scale up and so forth. What this slide shows, which is a very, very busy slide, is in essence the various players within the funding landscape, both from the perspective of the funders themselves, which ranges from the NRF, early stage funding, right through to other government departments, the Department of Science and Innovation, but also the DTIC and their various instruments. All of this just shows that the entire value chain has been considered, and what we're saying there is that there are various players that support the different stages of technology development and commercialization. Later on, I will talk about TIA. Next slide, please. So our position as the Technology Innovation Agency is a very interesting one. It is unrivaled. In essence, our role is to de-risk these innovations and make them more attractive for follow-on funders. And what the slides just shows is that we have various instruments within the organization that look at technologies, right from, I suppose, once the proof of concept has been demonstrated. We do that together with other university partners in particular. We fund some of these innovations ourselves, but also partner up with partners in the National System of Innovation for the commercialization. What that shows is really a sweet spot. We call the sweet spot of TIA, which is to de-risk these innovations and make them more attractive for follow-on funders. What this slide basically shows is that, since 2015, quite a large amount of money has gone towards supporting startups on the African continent. But of course, the majority of that funding is equity venture capital funding from various sources, such as impact investors, acceleration, incubation, and angel investors. Also, a lot of this funding is, in essence, let's call it small amounts of funding, ideally towards early stage investment deals of small ticket size, and we'll talk about this and whether this is a good idea for us as Africans and how we support our startup funders. So who's funding who? I will talk about this a bit more. So in essence, people who look alike, sound the same, tend to fund the same kinds of people. So this is typically, you know, in essence, white males who in essence will fund businesses run and owned by other white males as well. And what we're saying here is that this needs to change. We're certainly learning from this convention and various others that diversity is key. And in fact, what people will tell you is that when there is diversity, the participation of women, the participation of people of color, this is where we see success as far as what we're trying to do as a continent is concerned. Where you get educated plays a big role. In the past, I think the last 3 to 5 years, what we saw was that if you were African and you're educated in the USA, Europe, wherever it might be, anywhere outside of Africa, when you decided to return back to Africa and start your own, for example, venture capital fund, the funders from these, let's call them developed nations, tended to fund those students who came from the institutions. This is now changing, particularly where, in the case of African-led startups, where these Africans have been educated exclusively on the African continent, the money is now starting to follow them. What this means is that, you know, Africans are now able to articulate and of course are aware of the nuanced VC landscape in particular. So it makes sense for funders to come in and invest in these entities, startups, where the leaders and founders of these startups have been educated on the African continent, because then we know that as these limited partners, those funds will go quite far. It also means that we're able to create connections to pools of capital when these funds follow us. This is a very busy slide, colleagues, but the main point to be made here is that there is a lack of what we call institutional capital. So these are, in essence, pension funds, banks, mutual funds, hedge funds, endowments, insurance companies. Those funds are there. We know they are there. These are billions of US dollars of assets under management. But typically, they go into things like property and, in essence, let's call them less riskier assets. We've seen the data coming from the colleagues at SAFCA who've put out this data. But what the slide also shows that the funds are there. There's also what you call dry powder capital. In other words, funds that have not been invested. And this is something for us to think about, colleagues. We were talking about why these funds are not making their way into the kinds of risk investments we talk about here, biotech and the bioeconomy. The question then becomes, when venture capital does eventually land on our shores as Africans, where is the money going? So as a life scientist myself, this slide makes me feel sad because what we see there is a lot of this funding goes towards fintech. Fintech, in essence, has been the hot thing to invest in and will probably be so for quite some time to come. Followed by clean tech, the pressure has come from the likes of the United Nations and the SDGs and the goals and so forth to now start looking at investing in clean tech, particularly because of the pressure coming from climate change. And then, of course, we see small amounts, 7 to 9%, as far as agri-tech and health tech is concerned. But what this means, colleagues, is that there's an opportunity for us to come up with more inventions that can be commercialized, that will attract venture capital funding, and I dare say private equity funding as well. This slide is basically something that I'd like to share with the colleagues, just in terms of what funders are looking for. So those entities, and the quick message here is that those entities or those opportunities that invest in or develop platform technologies are becoming more and more attractive to funders. So anybody who's thinking about a technology that is a platform technology, in other words, that has the potential to be applied in various scenarios, that in essence allows you to come up with more than just one product, is now becoming very attractive as far as investors are concerned. Partnerships, very important. We've established this as an organization, TI ourselves. And this is a very busy slide as well, but basically talking a bit about our industry matching fund as TI, where we looked to partners such as the SASME Fund and the Public Investment Corporation, in essence looking at how we can leverage our funding as an organization. We've spoken to angel partners, we've spoken to venture capital, and the next stage, of course, is to now try to tap into those private equity funds I mentioned earlier on. This slide basically shows that for a little bit of money we've put in as TIA, invested as TIA, this has been very successful, in essence, attracting funding from either high net worth individuals and other corporates as well. Thank you, colleagues. That brings it to the end of my presentation.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pehane. I would also just ask, request your patience before we get into the actual dialogue and conversation. I would like Dr. Alama to also give us a presentation, a short presentation, showing us what is happening in, you know, outside of South Africa in terms of the funding or fundraising landscape, and especially the role of foreign direct investment. Dr. Alama.
Hi, good evening everyone. I'm Dr. Alama. Thank you to my colleague to start and to talk to us about funding in South Africa. I'm going to talk to you about funding in West Africa, especially French-speaking countries. I will talk in French, and Dr. Adrian will translate to you my speech. Thank you. Pour commencer, nous allons d'abord un peu faire un récap sur le stade d'avancement actuel de l'industrie pharmaceutique en Afrique de l'Ouest. Spécialement, nous allons prendre, vu que je n'ai pas assez de temps, nous allons prendre l'exemple sur la Côte d'Ivoire. Déjà, toute la région, nous pouvons dire que l'état d'avancement, malgré tous les efforts qui ont été faits, nous avons encore beaucoup de choses à faire. Les objectifs ne sont pas encore atteints à 30%. Donc, en prenant par exemple l'exemple sur la Côte d'Ivoire, compte tenu du déficit que nous avons à l'accès aux investissements essentiellement publics, parce que la majorité du système de santé en Afrique de l'Ouest, y compris, j'imagine même, y compris ici, est assurée par des fonds publics. Donc, dans nos pays, nous essayons un peu de revoir un peu la stratégie. Nous ne pouvons pas parler, il est très tôt pour nous de parler de biotechnologie dans nos pays. Peut-être au niveau du Sénégal, où grâce au programme Gavi, nous pouvons peut-être dire quelques mots sur la biotechnologie. Mais au niveau de la Côte d'Ivoire, sur l'industrie pharmaceutique, nous avons aujourd'hui 6 industries pharmaceutiques tunisiennes, industrie italienne, chinoise et indienne. Donc les pays de cette région se préparent et préparent l'environnement afin qu'ils soient attractifs pour la création de l'industrie pharmaceutique. Donc la mise en place d'une structure qui s'appelle CPCI, qui a été mise en place et qui a pour mission d'accompagner les projets de l'industrie pharmaceutique. Cette structure a commencé pour compenser le déficit. Nous avons le Conseil national de l'Ordre des pharmaciens qui met en place un projet qui a pour objectif de mettre en place un fonds de garantie de faciliter. Après tout ce qu'on vient de dire tout de suite, je suis désolée de ne pas regarder la présentation. Que la présentation concerne l'alignement des financements que je suis censée aborder à la fin de la session. Bon. Je m'excuse un peu d'aller très rapidement parce que j'ai un vol tout de suite, donc j'essaye un peu de récapituler et de dire l'essentiel pour au moins partager avec vous un peu ce qui se passe de l'autre côté de l'Afrique avant de libérer le podium à mes collègues. Cela étant, si vous avez des questions, je pourrai les répondre après en off. Hein. Il n'y a pas de souci par email ou par WhatsApp. Donc, en ce qui concerne le financement étranger, aujourd'hui, je ne pense pas qu'il soit aujourd'hui question même de débattre autour de l'utilité de tout ce qui est investissement étranger. L'histoire a prouvé l'impact positif des investissements étrangers à travers le monde, dans tous les secteurs, y compris au niveau du secteur de l'industrie pharmaceutique. Donc, si nous prenons, par exemple, avant d'arriver en Afrique, si nous prenons l'exemple des pays qui sont déjà assez développés en termes de biotechnologie et d'industrie pharmaceutique, nous nous rendons compte, en fait, qu'ils ont lancé le système grâce aux investissements étrangers. Nous prenons le cas, par exemple, de l'Inde. Quand ils ont commencé à zéro. Donc, ils n'avaient ni d'expérience, ni de fonds, ni la capacité de pouvoir mettre en place un système d'industrie pharmaceutique. Donc, ils ont facilité leur atmosphère, l'environnement qu'ils ont facilité et qu'ils ont rendu attractif à ces investisseurs étrangers, spécialement d'autres industries pharmaceutiques étrangères qui existent dans des pays qui sont déjà assez développés, les motiver à venir investir chez eux, à créer la main-d'œuvre, à créer de l'emploi, à créer de l'expertise et à mettre en place des structures qui, eux, ont pu, après, avec le temps, petit à petit passer la main et prendre l'indépendance sur le secteur pharmaceutique. Et on voit qu'aujourd'hui l'Inde, grâce à cette stratégie, n'a pas seulement pris cette indépendance au niveau de l'industrie pharmaceutique, mais aujourd'hui l'Inde sillonne à travers le monde, spécialement en Afrique. Donc si ça a pu marcher pour l'Inde, pourquoi ça ne marcherait pas pour nous? Et au second plan aussi, si vous prenez ces pays qui sont déjà assez développés, ils utilisent et mettent en valeur et exploitent aussi cette stratégie d'investissement étranger justement pour renforcer leurs capacités qu'ils ont déjà en place. Donc en Afrique, je ne pense pas qu'il est question aujourd'hui de trop débattre autour de ça. L'Afrique du Nord a fait énormément d'avancées en termes de biotechnologie et d'industrie pharmaceutique. Nous prenons l'exemple aujourd'hui de l'Algérie qui ont aujourd'hui 200 unités de fabrication, 200 usines pharmaceutiques aujourd'hui en Algérie. Ils ont eux aussi commencé par les investissements étrangers. Au niveau de l'Afrique de l'Ouest, je vais parler spécialement de l'Afrique de l'Ouest francophone, où certes aujourd'hui nous n'avons pas cette capacité de pouvoir fournir même 7% du besoin en médicaments au niveau local, les 93% sont assurés par les importations. Mais cette importation est faite aussi grâce à des structures qui sont spécialisées dans la logistique, qui sont des structures étrangères qui viennent investir chez nous. Et la majorité de ces structures, leur capital sont détenus par ces structures étrangères. Pour répondre à la question de docteur Adrian, l'investir reste une stratégie incontournable pour le secteur de l'industrie pharmaceutique en Afrique. Et c'est vrai que c'est un truc à double tranchant. Tout se joue dès le début. C'est-à-dire, dès le début, lorsqu'on veut attirer ces investisseurs étrangers à venir investir chez nous, il faudra que nous, dès le début, nous puissions négocier. Il faudra que le deal aille en faveur de notre continent, du début jusqu'à la fin, qui puisse nous permettre, nous, à long terme, de pouvoir monopoliser notre marché demain. Parce que la tentative a été faite plusieurs fois. L'échec est dû au fait que, une fois, le moment où il faut passer la main, c'est là où tout se joue. Le moment où il faut passer la main, nous devons nous partager le marché avec ces étrangers qui ont, eux, déjà exploité ce marché pendant plusieurs années. Donc, si le deal n'est pas bien négocié en faveur de l'Afrique, des Africains et du secteur de l'industrie pharmaceutique en Afrique, arriver à un stade... arriver à un stade, ça va avorter, ça ne va pas avancer. Voilà. Pour développer aussi cette industrie, cette stratégie d'investissement, il faudra non seulement le faire en nord-sud, mais aussi le faire en collaboration sud-sud. C'est-à-dire combler que au niveau de tous les stades de cette industrialisation, au niveau de tous les stades, d'essayer de mettre en place des collaborations entre les pays africains eux-mêmes d'abord, sélectionner les pays qui, eux, sont déjà avancés sur un certain plan, et ensuite compenser le besoin par les pays du Nord. Voilà, merci.
So, Dr. Alama, before you leave, I would just ask you to maybe just address the last issue, and I'll translate or give a summary of what she said before. But there's an intervention that...
I have to move in 4 minutes.
Is it? Okay. Yeah. No, that's fine. Then, so we can always share...
My colleague, I think that he can present my presentation. Right? You can present my presentation, right?
No pressure. Okay, but thank you. Thank you, Dr. Alama. We really appreciate it. So I'll just give a brief summary. Thank you. I'll give a brief summary of what Dr. Alama was talking about. So she was explaining some of the situation or giving a situation, a situational analysis of what's happening in French-speaking Africa. She gave the example of Senegal and Ivory Coast in terms of fundraising, and also a bit of what is happening in North Africa. I think what was really gripping to me was also the example of India, where she said, with the example of India, they started from nothing and they were able to attract foreign investment into the country, and they were able to create the industry, the biotech and pharma industry as we know it in India today, that is able to export and support countries across the globe, including countries in Africa. She also mentioned that with the foreign investment, we should be quite, you know, we should pay attention to how we structure the deals for those investments so that there is a handover to Africans to take over, you know, at the end of those deals, and we make sure that there is a win for Africa when there is a handover in those deals. So we wanted her to speak, it was intentional to speak in French. She can actually express herself in English, but we wanted, you know, that French-speaking Africans should also feel included in this platform, in this discussion. So I wouldn't want to, you know, go through her presentation again, but I would rather we spend the rest of the time with the rest of the panel talking about funding strategies for biotech entrepreneurs. So I'll take a seat now. Okay, so after the presentation that we've had from Dr. Pehane on giving us a landscape of funding across the continent, both across industries and specifically for biotech, and Dr. Alama telling us about the French-speaking countries in Africa, as well as giving examples of other countries like India from the south. I would like to ask Mr. Melfi. So you are in the venture capital space, and what are some of the key elements that you look for in biotech ventures when you're about to make investments?
Sure. Thanks, Adrienne. Thanks for having me on the panel. I think to boil it down to kind of three kind of key themes, tend to do that quite a lot in the line of work we're in. The science is hard enough. Trying to keep the funding landscape as simple as possible, equally important. So the three main kind of characteristics we look for, first and foremost, is exceptionally strong teams. Building a startup is hard, whether that be in biotech or not. Building a biotech startup, equally hard. And then building a biotech startup in Africa, hard. So you really need robust teams that are able to take some hard knocks, be able to be responsive to challenging questions, and to build from that. So we spend a lot of time working with early stage prospective founders or founders that are in the early stages of their venture to get to understand them, their backgrounds, where they're wanting to go, what they're wanting to build, and do we see that team as a team we can back and support long term. The second, from a kind of a VC angle and pushing to make VC applicable investments, we know that biotech is expensive, and we know it takes multiple rounds of funding, long time periods. So it's important to be building in a way that attracts VC-level investors. That's international standard. We try to kind of take our DD approach as sophisticatedly and as seriously as we possibly can to the same levels as international VCs. And what I mean by that is we need to be building to solve globally significant problems, and we need to be doing that with a competitive advantage. What is the reason you would build this biotech company in South Africa? that, you know, makes a compelling case when those elements stack up correctly, that we get very excited, we start continuing our DD, engaging with those particular founders even more so.
I particularly know that OneBio focuses on not just investing or providing investment capital, but also venture building alongside the entrepreneurs. Can you speak to that? Why is that important to OneBio?
Sure. So venture building or often sometimes confused or associated with some other elements. So accelerator programs, incubation programs, venture building, often kind of thrown into the same bucket. What we do at OneBio in terms of a venture build is there's no kind of program, quote unquote. Every biotech is different at a different stage. Every team is different and needs different elements of support. So we kind of try to take it on a case-by-case basis and support in those areas from a really early stage. And I mentioned earlier, you know, building solutions to globally significant problems is hard. They're global problems that a lot of companies around the world are trying to solve. So we look to kind of work with founders at an early stage, really hone down is into what is the problem you're addressing? Do you really understand the problem you're addressing? What is your proposed solution? Have you spent the time, really looked broadly as to what others are doing in that space? And then in that mix, also look at what is your competitive advantage? What's going to be the factor that brings your team to succeed in this against others? And we've been fortunate. We work with a number of great early stage founders who kind of have taken that steer and are going for it. So the venture build kind of element, I think the benefits are you get to work with prospective founders really early and provide insights. Both my business partner, Nick, and I have had experience abroad and kind of wanting to bring those experiences back and share them with early stage founders, trying to build a venture-backable company. I mentioned earlier, biotech is expensive. It's going to take numbers of rounds of funding. If you can set up your approach in the kind of pre-seed, early stage, non-dilutive capital phases to a solid base, you stand the best chance of following that trajectory.
Thank you so much for those insights. And yes, I think everyone in this room can attest and probably has good stories of, you know, the journey to finding funding and venture capital being one of those that it's really sometimes quite complicated, we don't know what to look for, how to position ourselves, how to, you know, become attractive for the venture capitals of the world. And it's really good to know that there is at least one that focuses on Africa, on companies early stage, especially in Africa. So that's quite encouraging. I would like to ask now, Ms. Hewlett, are there, apart from looking for venture capital funding, are there alternative ways to fund a biotech venture? And in your experience, can you share some examples and insights?
Sure, I can do that. I think a lot of companies start off and they really focused on finding investment partners, and it takes a lot of time. And one alternative strategy that we have looked at and we've employed is instead of looking for investment partners, consider looking for revenue partners. Because ultimately that does create so much more value in terms of increasing your bottom line, your profitability, and eliminating the risk or diluting your equity investment. So you can look at revenue partners in terms of how you can collaborate, work with people. You can look at a B2B model concept instead of where you're very fixed on promoting your own branding and product. You can manufacture for someone, let it be white labeled, and let them take the product to market. You're still manufacturing, you're bringing in revenue. You can look at B2C models where you partner with people to look at leveraging their marketing database and accessing their clients where they get a return of preferential access to your product or, you know, reduced pricing. So in our lifetime of NextBio over the 18 years, we've really focused on collaborations and partnerships, and we have done many, and they've really been beneficial to us. So I'll just highlight three quickly. When we first started off, our first partner was Netcare, and this enabled us to actually launch our stem cell banking in the Netcare hospitals, and they had preferential access for the first 6 months. And where that helped us was build out the processes. And for Netcare, it was great because they were seen as really innovative in terms of offering pregnant mums this opportunity to bank stem cells. We also did a partnership deal with Discovery Health, where they gave us access to all their members. And in return, we had to give all their members a 25% discount. Now, that's a whopping discount. And the best part of that is everyone thinks Discovery pays that. They don't. We fund it. But it's fine because Discovery get all the kudos and we get access to their members. And while the discount is rather big, if you're getting the volumes, and like it really helps, and then it also really adds to our credibility to have a really good medical insurer promoting your product. And a recent deal we've done is with one of the large pharmaceutical companies, Adcock Ingram. We manufacture biological products from the placenta for use in ophthalmology. And we just don't have the sales and distribution network that they have. So we've outsourced that. We've now partnered with them. And they're looking now to go out and market and distribute our ophthalmology products while we can focus on the manufacturing. So we benefit by their increased distribution, and they benefit by having a great innovative product in their basket of products. So, yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
And that maybe what Ms. Hewlett didn't mention is NextBio has been self-funded from the start. So she's speaking from experience. They've been going strong for 18 years. That's 1-8. It can be done.
Definitely.
It can be done.
It's not easy, but that's what makes it fun.
Thank you so much for sharing, and I'm sure you've inspired quite a few entrepreneurs that it is possible. Partnerships work if you take the pains to go through finding the right partners, credible partners, and offering value, because I'm sure your partners get value as much as you do, and that not just investment partners, but you can also look for revenue partners. Speaking of partnerships, I would like to bring Dr. Peane into the conversation. We talk a lot about PPPs, you know, engaging government in public-private partnerships. And I would just like to ask, what has been your observation and what is the relevance really in the biotech space for more involvement of public academia and industry partnerships, and how do we make those work effectively?
So thank you, Adrian. So from our experience, we've understood very well that the biotech space is expensive. It requires, let's call it, special skills, but also it's a long gestation type process. So you put in the money, you do all the experiments, there's a regulatory component of it that's required, and this is quite expensive, especially where the technology develops and now becomes, you know, possible to now engage in clinical trials. A lot of this funding is not readily available to the startup. And so what is required is, you know, organizations such as ourselves to take up this risk and invest and support these opportunities. But remember, this is always with, in our case, it is with public funds. So there's a requirement for us to do our due diligence properly and to make sure that indeed that which we're investing in has a market, there's a need for this kind of work. And so these partnerships are important, but also understanding that, you know, there is a role for government and there's a role for private sector as well. So those opportunities that are attractive to us are those that have demonstrated at least that there is a commercial partner on board. So there's, in essence, a private partner that has an interest in the technology and is likely to take it up because they see value in it. So our role as a state is really to de-risk the opportunity such that it is attractive for follow-on funding primarily by the private sector. So we call these partnerships. And those opportunities that come to us for funding from TIA that can demonstrate that there's a partner down the line that has an interest in this opportunity are those, in essence, that we would like to fund because we de-risk, and of course the risk is less because there's somebody on board to take up that opportunity. And so we've learned very quickly that our role as TIA must be defined, it must be specific, but of course we're looking for the private sector to come in. And so typically, you know, we'd approach other partners in the space, the Public Investment Corporation, it might be the DBSA, various new opportunities now, the BRICS banks, and it might even be foreign banks, you know, Deutsche Bank and so forth, to say, you know, this is what we're doing as TIA. It is with government funds, but our funds are limited. Very, very important. Can they come in? We typically ask the question, you know, as Kim has answered, how are you going to make money? And those opportunities that are very clear on how they are going to make money, who they're going to partner up with in private sector, are those, of course, that we find quite attractive. And so some partners, of course, have been, I suppose, reluctant to put in money into these opportunities, particularly your, let's call them commercial banks. But of course, you know, over the years, as recently as 2 to 3 years ago, we're now seeing banks, local banks, such as Nedbank, Standard Bank, now also investing in technology development, technology companies. We're seeing more of this, as you've seen, and in the African trends, the global trends, in the fintech space, and less so, you know, in the biotech space. And of course, we'll continue, you know, prodding along and trying to get these partners on board. It is our role as government to ensure that we have these partners on board with us. But it's very important that there's recognition that there are other pools of funding, what we call the non-traditional pools of funding, coming from private equity space. As I mentioned, private equity people, you know, have their interest in property, for argument's sake. A few of them are starting to open up now to venture capital, particularly in these models around the fund of funds. So we see them now opening up to say, let us fund somebody who will fund somebody else. It matters not to us how these monies, you know, move along the trajectory of tech development and support, as long as they get to where we want them to get to, which is in essence the biotech space and the bioeconomy space.
Thank you. I think that paints a really clear picture. But I just want to recap what we've done so far. So we've talked about the funding ecosystem across Africa. We've also looked at, you know, some investment strategies from a venture capital perspective, as well as different strategies to obtain funding. Also looking at, you know, one of those strategies being partnerships. So I'd like to welcome questions from our audience at this point before we continue our conversation. Does anyone have questions for the panel? Are there any biotech entrepreneurs in the room interested in funding? Thank you. Please.
Thank you so much. My name is Karanja. I'm from Vilgro, Africa, and excited to learn about the kind of funding available for innovators. I wanted to understand what ticket size do you do at OneBio, and also if you can just one or two companies that at least to kind of get a sense of the type of startups you fund.
Thanks, Kim. Thanks for your question. I think, sorry, there's a bit of an echo, but I think I caught it there. Just to get a bit of a flavor of where we look to invest in biotech and maybe some of the portfolio.
And the ticket size.
Sorry?
Ticket size.
How much? Sure thing. So, I mean, just to start on the kind of the investment thesis and kind of where we look, I think the elements we spoke about earlier, what we look at from prospective investment opportunities. But in terms of the scope, we look at biotech with a very open lens. I think anywhere where a biological system is involved, so that's future of food space, therapeutics, diagnostics, really anywhere where the life sciences and biology is coming into play. In terms of ticket size, you know, ranging from 3.5 million rand to 13 million rand at a pre-seed seed stage, looking at follow-ons as well thereafter. But to give you maybe a bit more context to some of the companies we've supported and continue to support, some of which here today. Sorbonne Mycelium, doing incredible work in the world of mycelium and bioprospecting for very novel and interesting molecules for use in multiple industries. Pandora Biosciences, we were here earlier as well, very much more in the kind of therapeutic kind of health space. Where we see a lot of interesting opportunities is really in this merger between our ability in the last number of years to produce masses of biological data and how we interpret that data. This is a theme you'll see in other geographies, right? Taking advantage of advances in machine learning, AI, to find deeper insights within the genetic space, let's say, for target discovery and validation, or in the diagnostic space. So a couple of companies in that vein. And then also very interested in the future of food. You know, overarchingly, our thesis is to try and, we're not an impact investor per se, but the opportunities we look to support we hope will have an impact in both human and planetary health, One Health as it's often referred to. So again, fairly broad remit, range of check sizes, and as Adrian mentioned earlier, you know, we really like to support founders from a very early stage. As I said, if you can set the grounding right and you can build knowing that you're going to need to raise subsequent rounds of funding and set up that structure right, there's no reason South Africa can't have the types of moonshots we see in other ecosystems. We have the talent, we have sources of funding, TIA, the DSI, we were very lucky to manage a CIFA grant facility for early stage POC, and we have the VC kind of infrastructure following suit. So I think if there is a takeaway, it's that we are currently building. We've made 8 investments to date, hope to make a few more in the next year and a half, look to raise another fund. It's happening, and there's no reason we can't be producing the level and caliber of company other ecosystems, whether it be Boston, San Francisco, the UK, you name it. We can compete at that stage, definitely. I hope that answers your question.
So if I may, so thanks very much. So for just around that, I mean, one of the things we do as well, having recognized that venture capital companies in the past have tended to come in at the later stages. But we're seeing the trends now that they're now coming at the earlier stages, so early stage venture capital. And this is very attractive to us because what we've done as TIA now is to look at how we can capacitate this through our seed fund instrument. We are finding that more and more where we've invested as TIA in seed capital, particularly with our partnerships and partners at the universities, higher education institutions, we see that these opportunities now become attractive venture capital as well. So for us, it's really to sort of seed in the true sense of seeding, because we know that, you know, there will be early venture capital uptake by these opportunities. And of course, you know, the institutions that we select, these high education institutions that we select is done, and we do some due diligence around that. And in essence, looking for those institutions that have a tech transfer office, that have a bit of an IP policy around that. Some of the things that we are concerned about as government, having putting in, you know, state funds, is the flight of IP, which is almost as horrible as, you know, the illicit flow of funds, you know, from the continent and so forth. And so these institutions, of course, that have these policies and have these, I suppose, this awareness around the protection of IP, particularly where it is state funded intellectual property, those become more attractive to us. So those relationships, of course, will be very important. Those partnerships will be very important for an organization such as ours.
Any other questions? Thank you. There's a hand in the front. Microphone, please.
Thank you. Besides a proof of concept, how much weight do investors place on offtake agreements for businesses, and how much do those de-risk the business investment? And subsequently, especially within the bio space, do you then feel that DFIs and heads of state have a responsibility to support local businesses?
I'll take that first. Okay, super. So, you know, regarding the responsibility of DFIs to support local business, it is very, very important. And I'm quite passionate about this. And the reason for this is because we speak all the time around, you know, our ability to demonstrate that we support local manufacturing and that we support local SMEs and startups. But unfortunately, you know, our regulation and law in the country, particularly around the state tenders, is that the cheaper the price, the higher it ranks just in terms of being awarded. This is particularly tragic because what happens is when we put out these tenders, we find people who've been in the business for a long time, sitting in countries like India, China, who are very competitive price-wise for various reasons, able to compete with our local companies for those tenders. And they more often, they win these tenders. And this is something that, of course, government has said they will look at and change these laws just so that we benefit local entities. Offtake agreements are very, very attractive to us. But, you know, those entities that come to us and say, we've got a particular technology at a particular stage, we already have an offtake agreement. This gives us surety, you know, as a state, and confidence as a state that there is a real partner on the other end that will be taking up this particular opportunity. It is not that we insist that there be an offtake agreement. It can even be in the form of an expression of interest. If this particular entity takes this technology development to a particular stage, we will certainly engage with them on issues of price, on issues of supply, et cetera, et cetera. And it's at that stage that we get very interested, particularly as TIA, because it means then that, as I said, there's somebody interested on the other side. It then becomes easier for us to even put in second round funding, because quite often these technologies need to develop to a certain stage. There might be requirement for expansion capital and facilities to be set up in second round funding. We can certainly look at it. Our appetite is greater for us as TIA because we know that there is indeed an expression of interest, and even better, an offtake agreement along the lines of that particular opportunity.
That answers your question. Any other questions, either for Kim, Marco, or Dr. Peani? If there are no questions, I know there are biotech entrepreneurs in the room, so maybe you already have funding. Can you maybe share your story of how you navigate the funding complexities to, you know, run a biotech or start a biotech venture on the continent? So I'm gonna maybe flip the mic. If anyone would love to share an anecdote, a story, an example that maybe our panel has not yet touched on that you think would benefit the audience, please. You can also grab the mic.
While you're looking for someone, oh, this is loud. While someone's plucking up the courage to share a story, I thought it's pretty apt now. I'd like to just quickly touch on three funding trends that have emerged over the recent while. And the most important thing is that the world has really changed, okay? And since the financial crisis, when interest rates were almost zero, funding was very, very cheap, and there was a proliferation of capital looking for investment. And a lot of this investment found homes and backed ideas that possibly should never have been backed. And this created this large bubble that was just fantastic for innovation. As it fueled innovation, wasn't so great for investors. But this has continued. And then COVID came, and it was like the end of this long funding partner. It's like finding that last bottle of cheap tequila, and you just keep going, and we are now, that party keeps going, and now we're sitting with a massive hangover, and where interest rates have gone sky high, funding has completely, you know, diminished, and we're back to the basics of investment and funding, and where financial discipline is really important, and it now takes a front seat and bootstrapping companies. So we almost come full cycle, we're back there. The second point is the emergence of corporate investment ventures, and this is where corporates understand the role and the importance of innovation, and they're setting up innovation venture funds because, as we all know, you can't innovate inside a large corporate due to bureaucracy, red tape, and short-term profit incentives. So, and what these venture funds do help them, it gives them the ability to learn and understand where they could be disruptive. It gives them access to emerging technologies that they can take advantage of. But more importantly, it gives them insights into how they can align their strategies. So that's the second point. And then the third point is governments are actually playing an increasing role. And the UK, for example, has stated that they want to become a science powerhouse by the year 2030. And it was only last month that the UK Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, I think is his name, yeah, where he unveiled the Mansion House thing, and he said he's committed that 9 of the UK's top defined contribution pension funds will invest 5% of their assets into unlisted investments by the end of 2030. And this could unlock a potential of about £5 billion in investment, and that's massive. And that will really drive growth, boost technology development, create jobs, and ultimately tax collection. So I think in that insight in itself is something for us as African leaders and policyholders to take note of.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for bringing that in. And yes, absolutely, the trends have changed. We've we've had the good ride, right? And I like the analogy of the hangover. So yes, a little bit more discipline back to fundamentals, and I'm glad that we've touched on those fundamentals here. One thing that I have been concerned about looking from the sidelines in is, yes, there's a lot of startups, biotech startups, but there aren't a lot that are long-lived or, you know, gone on to, you know, be a story that others can look up to and emulate. And I'm curious, Marco, in terms of funding strategies, how can biotech entrepreneurs manage a growth strategy alongside their funding strategy? And in this case, aiming for long-term growth. So not just, you know, starting something, selling it off, merging or something like that, but actually looking for something more sustainable.
Sure. I think, good question, a tough question. I mean, I think the timescales involved in biotechnology are already significant, right? If you look at the therapeutic space from zero to drug available in the clinic, 10 to 12 years, and it's a long road to walk. So where we kind of focus in terms of setting up these companies to take that path and walk that path, the focus is on building an attractive investment case, solving a significant problem. And if you're able to do that and show a competitive advantage, a really compelling competitive advantage, it's still not going to be easy to raise along that road, but you're setting yourself up to try. You know, it's not uncommon for a biotech company to never generate revenue is not uncommon. We at OneBio, we look at a number of companies, and so far down our list is actually revenue generation. If you're building a disruptive technology that's going to take 7, 8, 9, 10 years to get there, you need the patient capital support to work with you along that time frame and take on that risk. It scares a lot of people, even other colleagues in VC when they hear, you know, what we look at and the timescales it takes. So it is doable. There are examples, you know, in other ecosystems, but it's having that capital that can hang in there and making sure that those companies can raise from like-minded investors as they go. So from a long-term trajectory growth point of view, 10 years is a long time. Beyond that, you know, if successful, you get to the point of looking, okay, what's market entry going to be? How is this going to be used most effectively? So, yeah, the timescales are already long at best. But, yeah, we hope we're setting up in the right way.
Yes.
So from our perspective, just to latch on to what you've just said, so, you know, one of the things we encourage investees to do, what we call our investees, is to think about inbound technology transfer. In other words, where around the world can you go and in-license technologies for the purpose of what you're trying to do? And these may be complementary technologies. There might be technologies also just to assist you with generating income for yourself. But of course, you know, then things become a bit complex depending on, you know, the stage of this IP that you're trying to bring in, where it is still, you know, tinted. And now we're speaking, you know, around, you know, cross-licensing and in-licensing, you know, who's going to share what royalties and so forth. And then the discussion around patent pools, you know, and some of these clearing houses comes up, you know, is infringement, possibly infringement and so forth. These can be really complex and complicated discussions. All sorts of lawyers need to come in and negotiate those particular contracts. But these should not be seen as impediments, you know, towards these negotiations, going out there and getting this IP, particularly for us, you know, sitting on the African continent, who might not have the luxury of large investments and well-established biotech companies. What this means, colleagues, is that then we need to be thinking about smart deals and particularly investing in skills to be able to negotiate these contracts, whether it be commercial lawyers, you know, or lawyers who are used to negotiating these license deals and so forth. Very, very important. And we also think about, you know, the types of agreements we enter into, you know, as TIA, and whether these actually enable follow-on funding or not. So that's a very interesting discussion for those colleagues who are in the space of deal making and deal structuring, because there are many, many, many more opportunities where this is concerned. Thank you.
Hello? Hello?
Yes, there's another question. Okay, there's a first question at the back and then...
Yeah. Hi, good evening, everyone. I'd first like to thank everyone for such a wonderful talk about startups and the funding, how South Africa is supporting and encouraging, you know, modern therapeutics and emerging biomedical companies, you know, for growing and, you know, supporting them in best possible way. We also know that South Africa happens to be a member of BRICS lobby, and a lot of tech transfer happens between the BRICS nation. So what's your take when it comes to funding those companies when they try to introduce themselves into the South Africa for funding? And if so, like, have you done any in you know, like, investment in such companies for tech transfer?
Tech transfer from other BRICS countries to South Africa, if I got the question correct?
Yes.
Okay. We'll be able to take that.
All right, I'm under fire here. So thank you very much for your question, sir. And I think, you know, it's really upon us, you know, as BRICS countries, and I know I'm aware of the new additions to the BRICS family, to think about these contracts and the ability for us to support technologies and companies coming from other BRICS countries. I think, you know, we will need to have these discussions just in earnest, because we do have bilaterals and trilaterals and so forth with these various countries. But of course, you know, there's always the concern around who's going to fund what and who's bringing what quantities of funds into this BRICS relationship. And so I think, you know, some of these things we need to be discussed. What I can tell you is that coming from the recent BRICS meeting in South Africa, there's now a very serious effort just around looking at, you know, what we do as BRICS countries and as South Africa around the nuclear medicine space. And this is in essence identified as one of the, let's call it, flagship projects that must be looked at within the BRICS family. We'll certainly be looking to that. We have a keen interest where that is concerned, considering, you know, where we sit as a country, our expertise, infrastructure around nuclear medicine. But I think it should not only be limited to nuclear medicine. We can certainly talk about, you know, what we have as strengths as a country around agriculture and, of course, in our ability to go into animal breeding and so forth, our initiatives around industrial biocatalysis and various other technologies as well. But all of this, you know, requires, in my view, for us to have the right people at the negotiating table, because we're certainly aware of what is sitting here in those BRICS countries, and we certainly want to access those technologies for the benefit of the African continent. But I'm sure, you know, as India, as China and so forth, you'd want the same for yourselves. But so let's have the conversations. I'm very keen.
Thank you. And just to highlight, on the dialogue with African biotech leaders, we are going to be working on, you know, having topic-specific discussions like these ones, where we'll bring experts and people with experience from across different sectors to cover specific topics like IP issues and different sectors, agri-specific topics and therapeutics. So thank you for your question, and we'll definitely be looking to, you know, have such discussions in depth as we, you know, roll out this platform. We'll have another question, and then I'm also aware of time, So we'll be wrapping up shortly.
Thank you. Mine will be very quick. First one is for Vui. You mentioned the question of the IP and how do we avoid the IP, you know, flight. And I think part of the challenges we see is how we structure the funds. As local fund managers or GPs, being able to raise, you know, patient capital, evergreen funds is a major challenge. And in the strategy that you're taking at TIER as a fund of funds, are you looking at a way, mechanism of supporting more evergreen funds as opposed to the closed funds? And then for the other panelists, including you still, the other question I have is, when we look at the whole knowledge economy, I see us talking a lot, you know, we're kind of really into this Silicon Valley model, which again always ends up with dilution and so on and so forth. And biotech is interesting because sometimes biotech is national security. When I look at Germany, it's very different. I see big pharma that's family owned. I see, you know, like almost all their multinationals tend to be family owned. So there's something they're able to do where they're able to build global multinational companies that without the level of dilution that you see, which would still also go back to the issue of IP flight. And I'm asking myself, what is it that they're doing that we need to learn? I'm very curious on any insights on that. Thank you.
If I may. You're gonna go first? Oh, okay, all right. Yeah, so thanks very much, Robert, for that particular question. So, you know, ourselves as TIA, you know, we have looked at the opportunity of, in essence, being a fund of funds, particularly for funds from the state, and more in particular the Treasury, which comes through the Department of Science and Innovation. And where this stems from is just our realization, but also participation in one of the new instruments coming from Treasury and managed, you know, through the Department of Science and Innovation, which is the Innovation Fund, as it were. And what we've realized is that, you know, as the state, it's very important that we are seen to be playing a much bigger role, because, you know, the amount of funds is significant. We're talking, you know, over R1 billion of investment opportunity. But of course, you know, that particular pot of money was not only given to TIA to manage, but various other players in the space. And that particular approach was taken by Treasury and the DSI just to see, you know, who's actually good at what they say they can do and where might the opportunities come just in terms of a fund of funds. As TIA, as a funding agency of the department, you know, we competed with other fund of funds organizations such as the SSME Fund, the PIC, and I think the IDC as well. So a number of us were playing this particular space. But what is coming out of this is that the fund of funds model itself is a much better and, I suppose, instrument and has greater impact, because not only, you know, do you get to distribute your money, but you actually get to distribute your money quite quickly and you see impact much faster. So if the other players in the space were able to position themselves to be recipients of these funds that they can deploy very quickly to those opportunities, that they assess themselves and evaluate themselves, all the better for us as a country. You know, regarding the question around, you know, family offices and so forth, we have done a bit of research ourselves as an organization, looking at how, you know, where the funds are sitting, for example, in the Middle East, you know, and those particular family offices, which of course, you know, have seen, you know, their wealth being generated from their natural resources, oil and so forth. And we do see those particular family offices as an opportunity for us to think about, even within ourselves, within the country, and to approach those family offices. Why do I say that? Is because those particular family offices are very nimble. You know, they know how to look at opportunities, they have assistants to look at those opportunities, and they make decisions very quickly. You know, we find in our space, with our limited, you know, source of funding, we in essence need to do a very deep due diligence. And in fact, a recent survey that was done on the South African venture capital space is that, you know, venture capital companies do think 10 times about these opportunities, especially where there's going to be a requirement for significant due diligence to be done. It does not make sense that the cost of due diligence is more than the actual opportunity itself. It doesn't make sense at all, you know. And so some of these come up as impediments to venture capital, and in fact, the loss of opportunity, as it were, for some of these, you know, the opportunities that come across their desks. So, you know, my desire is to start getting us to think about a fund of funds, to think about these various sources of funding, family offices being one of those, high net worth individuals and so forth, but more importantly, the private equity space. You know, the more we have various sources of funding, I think the more we can make a difference, you know, as ourselves, as a country, but also as a continent. Very interestingly as well, on the African continent, there are high net worth individuals, there are family offices, but a lot of these family offices tend not to be advertised. You tend not to know who's actually out there. You know, they prefer to sort of stay under the radar, as it were, and very quietly go out and find opportunities. Very, very important that we develop intelligence around understanding who those people are and what they invest in. We also find that these family offices aren't run in the main by the actual families themselves, but they have consultants to help them do these kinds of things. Again, you know, one needs to understand the space, the market, understand, get your intelligence sorted out in terms of who is controlling the money and who is making decisions. You know, what are the desires of these particular family offices, and then go into those family offices and present the opportunity.
For the interest of time, is there one last burning question from the audience? Otherwise, I will ask maybe for the QR code to be projected, please. If you can help us and just scan this code and take a short 2-minute survey, just to give us your feedback on this session, on the topic that was covered, and also some ideas on how to proceed with this platform. And while you're doing that, I'll ask our panel to give us last words on this topic, navigating funding, especially for biotech on the African continent. So I'll start with you, Kim.
So I'd rather give a concluding message really as an entrepreneur here. And my fundamental belief is that us as Africans are the most incredible people, and we are so diverse. We have to deal with extreme disparities, and it makes us really so much more creative. We just go out and we make things happen with very limited resources. And for me as an entrepreneur, the key thing is for us to work together, because I find that we're so busy competing with each other that before we know it, an international competitors come in and they eat our lunch because we're too busy. And instead of, we should be working together to leverage our respective skills, build, you know, extract economies of scale, and yeah, together we can just do so much more. And that's my message, to say let's all work together.
Thank you so much, Kim. Yes, Marco?
Sure, I think kind of closing remarks, I think one thing that I kind of like to mention when talking at events like this or to others is the fact that this is happening. Early stage biotech is happening. This isn't a plan to take on early stage biotech in South Africa. We've got all kinds of gears in motion for it to happen. We mentioned some of, you know, for One Bio's portfolio, just for name a few, but there are a number of early stage entrepreneurs taking on this challenge and going after it. And I think we can count ourselves lucky as South Africans that we have a number of kind of funding mechanisms in place. Yes, more can always be done. Biotech's expensive. We've all agreed on that front. But the fact that we're gaining momentum and you get to meet these entrepreneurs and work with these entrepreneurs is a privilege and a pleasure. So my takeaway is, if there's anyone watching on the live stream or anyone who maybe has been too shy to answer a question or ask a question, I should say, is if you're thinking about it, reach out, try. If One Bio isn't the correct fit, we will gladly make introductions to those who we think we would be. So essentially build now. If you've got an idea, if you want to pursue it, there are mechanisms. We're very lucky to have them. Let's use them.
Translation, One Bio is sourcing deals. If you have a biotech idea.
Thanks, Andrew.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Peane, for your last word.
Super, thank you very much. So I think what's important for us as South Africans, but also more importantly as Africans, is that there is dialogue amongst ourselves. I do believe that, you know, the space under the sun is very large. I think we can accommodate everybody, not only those individuals who are established in their businesses, but also those individuals who aspire to create a living for themselves. I'm particularly speaking about what we call the grassroots innovators. Very important that we don't forget those people as well. I think a lot of it has to do with being very deliberate. So when we look at, you know, what happened in pre-1994 South Africa, for example, there were laws that were created to say there is a Cecil Act or whatever act, where there were deliberate interventions by government to pump in large amounts of money into specific industries because they had been recognized, there was the recognition of certain skills and of course the recognition around certain mineral deposits in the country. And so those are very deliberate interventions by government. We see this as well with the likes of China, who said, no, this is where we need to be in the next 100 years. Some countries think 100-year horizons. This is what we need to do regarding skills, access to certain minerals. Let's stockpile these things and let us now add value, you know, to these imports from around the world, and let us sell to the rest of the world high value products that in essence make them very, very competitive. So for me, it's really about being very deliberate about what we do. We certainly don't need to ask for permission from anybody around the world because we know our own situation. And so I look forward to this kind of thinking. Thank you.
So much to our panel, and thank you to the audience who have been very patient, very engaging, very, you know, the questions that you've asked to the audience or to the panel have been thought-provoking, and I'm sure that the information that has been exchanged back and forth will inspire you to, you know, dream more and, you know, have the tactics and the ideas, new ones, or just going around old ones in new ways so that we can have a thriving biotech industry in Africa and take you know, charge of our challenges and turning some of those into, you know, opportunities for ourselves. And this platform that we've started, the dialogue with African biotech leaders, like Kim said, just repeating what she said, we need to collaborate more. We need to, you know, have a platform where we engage, we network, and we exchange, you know, thoughts and ideas. Maybe something that's working in Egypt can inspire a new way of thinking about, you know, doing things in the South and as well. The previous panel also emphasize this point around collaboration. So it's collaboration, collaboration, collaboration. And so I want to thank you, also those following online, for having stuck with us in this discussion. And we'll be having more engaging events. So just keep connected. If you are not yet on the platform, we do have a LinkedIn page. Follow BioAfrica on the website. There's also a link that will take you to the Dialogue with African Biotech Leaders platform. And on that note, yes, thank you so much. And we look forward to continuing this conversation and building a thriving biotech industry in Africa. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.